Higher, which is part of the Socialist History of Britain course. Wayman Bennett, who wants to be described as a member of the SWP, will be speaking for about 30 minutes or so. There's not going to be speaker slip system, but people still need to use the microphone. So without further ado, introduce Wayman Bennett.
Right, comrades, why do we want to talk about the British Empire? After all, most of us hate it. The first thing to be said is that, last week, Radio 4 had been running a series of meetings or series of discussions about the British Empire. And the editor of the Daily Telegraph started off by saying this. He said, "We have to fight off the Dennis Potter view of the British Empire." And he said that Dennis Potter said, "Thank God we'd buried that disgusting myth of power that we all were involved in." And I think, I actually think that what Dennis Potter said was absolutely right. The person from the Telegraph responded in this way and said, "Listen," he said, "look at what happened last week at Wimbledon. That chap Washington, who played at Wimbledon, would have known nothing about the game if it hadn't been for the British Empire. We gave the world tennis, cricket, railways. We should be absolutely proud of ourselves. After all, the world was a swamp before we came." Now, I'm not going to argue that, I think that this is, I'm not going to argue this is the predominant view of the British Empire. Bigoted journalist. But what is true is that there's been a whole series, resurgence of people writing about the British Empire. The Cambridge edition of the British Empire has been released. And I think there's three reasons why we should talk about the British Empire. The first thing I want to say, is that the birth of the British Empire was about mass looting. And when we talk about the British Empire, it's a recent phenomenon. It's not something, people tend to view it as something that's been around for four centuries and has always existed. The empire that had 24 million square miles was really formed around 1880. The empire that I want to talk about is the empire of the beginning of the British Empire, which is, something which historians don't want to talk about, but I do. And I think the reason why it's important for socialists is because it's about the rise of capitalism. It's about the rise of a system of oppression and exploitation. And I think that you can explain where it comes from and about how to destroy it. The third thing about it is that, the question of the British Empire affects us today. I think that when you look to places in Africa, when you look to the leader of Nigeria, a man called Babangida, when he says that what unites everybody is the fact that they were forced to fight against British imperialism, and that everybody shared an interest in the empire, the British workers shared an interest in the empire, I think is something which we have to reject. And I think searching for the history about what actually happened means that you can explain how the British Empire developed and where it came from. And I think I want to start off with a quote from Marx. By the way, the early British Empire was overwhelmingly white. It wasn't black. If you look at it was Canada, Australia, America. That's really what you say. But I think if you start off with Marx gives an explanation about what was the basis for the British Empire and where it comes from. And Marx says this. He says that when you talk about British Empire, you're really talking about the genesis, the primitive accumulation of capital. And he describes the way that the British Empire comes into the world is the same way as it does with capital. He says it comes into the world with a congenital bloodstain on one cheek. It comes in dripping from head to toe, from every pore, with blood and dirt. And really, this is the basis of explaining where the British Empire came from. Because historians want to describe it as some kind of immaculate conception. This man called Lawrence James, who says, it was the sheer verve and imagination of the British that led to the rise of the British Empire. I would argue that it was something else completely different. It's about the development of capitalism, a system that was exploitative and destructive, and actually that's what the early part of the British Empire was about. When Marx talked about primitive accumulation, in other words, stealing from around the globe, that's really where the British Empire really gets its foundation. The British Empire was really formed by companies like the East India Company around 1600, the Hudson Bay Company, and these created fantastic profits. If you invested £1, you got in the equivalent of £100 back from that investment. It wasn't thriftiness and the strength of the British will that built the empire, but much more the navy. The fact that the Britain had a set of ships and was, you know, which gave it a competitive edge over the rest of people. It was the use of slavery in order to make huge profits that was important. I mean, people might have heard of a man called James Hawking. When he went to Africa, another company formed under the early part of the British Empire called the Royal African Company was one of the first organised slave ships. What was the name of his ship? The Good Ship Jesus. Do you know what I mean? In a sense, but what did it bring? When it landed, the basis for the reason why they'd come to Africa was that they said that they came there to, as he put it, they came there because there was easy money to be made. Between 1672 and 1713, Britain made £12 million. In other words, it was a means of international stealing, sucking wealth in. That's what fundamentally gave the British Empire its first start. I mean, when people today talk about globalisation, and you know they talk about it in a benign way, the way that capitalism developed, actually they ought to take a good look at how the British Empire developed. It developed in the 16th century through the fact that the Britain passed laws called navigation laws that locked other countries out from being able to trade. A consequence of this was war. I mean, that's why there was endemic war in the 16th and 17th century. Why was Britain able to build a world empire compared to countries like Spain and Portugal? I mean, you know, a few people know about Columbus and people like that. You know that they went there first. Why is it that Portugal or Spain didn't develop huge empires in the same way? There's a simple answer, really, in this sense, that the way that, you know, that when they robbed the Aztecs, when they robbed places around the world, basically what they did was just basically go there and steal the gold. The effect of this in Europe was actually that there was lots of gold, there was lots of silver, and it strengthened the feudal ruling class inside Spain and Portugal. In Britain, actually, the way that the development of the empire worked was to strengthen the rising bourgeois, the rising bourgeoisie. That's the class that was strengthened. Whereas in places like Spain and Portugal, it stopped the growth of capitalism. It made capitalism grow in a much slower way. Why is this important? Because I think that when you're ripping up the racist history that we're taught about the origins of the British Empire, when you read people like Eric Williams, when you read a man called Wallerstein about the development of the British Empire, what they often argue is that it was the colonies and slavery that led to the development of capitalism in Britain, that led to the development of a capitalist class. I think those are excellent books that they've written. You know, Peter Fryer writes a book about staying power, history of black people in Britain. Eric Williams writes a book about capitalism and slavery. And I wouldn't fault it in terms of being the weapons that expose racism, the roots of racism, where it comes from. But in terms of explaining the British Empire and what it's about, I think that the key question really is that capitalism was already developing in Britain, and the fact that they were exploiting workers was one of the, or the early workers was one of the ways that they made where they made fantastic wealth. It wasn't trade that led to the development of capitalism in Britain. Trade or the rise of the empire was a byproduct of the development of capitalism in Britain. The other thing about the nature of the development of the empire was the idea that everybody enjoyed it or everybody was a part of it. Early on, you know, often you can tell more about a system right at its beginning. Like, for instance, the British Navy was multiracial. It wasn't true that it was only made up of of whites. Actually, it was made up of people that had been pressed into service. I mean, one example is that in the 1550s, when a man called Henry Hudson lands in America to set up one of the early settlements, the first thing that his men do is kill him. Do you mean? They killed the captain of the ship, and the reason why they killed him was because really they didn't share any of his interest in terms of coming there really to exploit the land, to help pillage and take the land away from the Indians. In fact, the means of stealing people or spiriting them away, as it was said in the early part of the 16th century, what they did, they simply got hold of the landless peasants, the unemployed workers, and just made them press them into the navy or press them into services, indentured service. In fact, if you shouted the word spirit in towns inside London, you could cause, in London or in various other places, you could cause a riot, because the way that people have been pressed into service and pulled into being part of the British Navy, forced into indentured labour. And in this sense, what that tells you is that the people that benefited from British imperialism wasn't workers. There's a man called Leo Huberman who says the first effect of the British Empire was to pauperise the people in Britain. And the basis of the reason why that the British Empire could build up and take control over different parts of America, take control of parts of Canada and America, was the fact that they had a centralized state. And this is one of the most important things about why the British Empire was able to take control over places around the world. I mean, if you look at the English Civil War, one of the reasons why they overthrew Charles I was the fact that the rising bourgeoisie didn't think that Charles I was fulfilling their interest in terms of trying to build a colonial empire that expanded beyond the means of expanded beyond Britain. I mean, people like actually Samuel Pepys, the diarist. I don't know if people have heard of him. He was one of the people that streamlined the British Navy and made it possible for them to go around the world and dominate. I mean, the second thing that they did was invent the national debt. I mean, something which we pay for all the time. But I mean, what they did because they formed joint stock companies, they formed the Bank of England, they could then centralise all their power into having a military force that could take over bits and pieces of countries around the world and then build that in the interest of Britain. But the fundamental reason for this was profit. That's the reason why they wanted to build the British Empire. It was the development of mercantile capitalism that gave the impetus for empire. And you can see this in particularly around slavery, that the fact that they made £150 million. I mean, I haven't been able to work that out in today's money, but it works out to be billions. This was the reason why that was one of the major impetus for the formation of the British Empire. I mean, they've estimatedly moved 15 million people from one place to the people from Africa to Britain. Adam Smith, the capitalist economist who wrote a book called The Wealth of Nations, said that the profits of a sugar plantation in any of our West Indian economies are much greater than any other cultivation inside Europe. And I think that one of the arguments about the development of empire is that the indigenous population, the British population, workers, benefited from the situation that took place of the development of empire. I mean, I don't know if people have read a man called Daniel Defoe. He wrote a book called Robinson Crusoe, yeah? It's a terrible book, Friday, he has a head, Friday puts his head down on the ground and lets Robinson Crusoe put his foot on his head. Do you mean? In that sense, it's an expose of what British imperialism was all about. But he actually wrote another book at the same time as he wrote the book on Robinson Crusoe. I mean, he was the son of a whole merchant, and he writes down what happens when he's going around Britain, and at the time of the development of the British Empire, when a West Indian slave owner and a Manchester merchant meet and discuss what they're going to do, and he chronicles this discussion. He says, the slave owner says, I've always thought myself disgraced by being a slave owner, but we never in the West Indies thought it possible for any human being to be so cruel to a child of 9 to expect it to work 12 and a half hours a day. The Manchester merchant replies, child labour is absolutely necessary, and we learned it from you, sir. Right? In other words, what he's saying is, I mean, I'm not arguing that the destruction, the way that slavery destroyed people's lives, wasn't rapacious inside the West Indies in terms of making profit for people. But what I am arguing is that if the people that benefited from that were the slave class, the plantocracy class, and the people in Britain who were part of the manufacturing circuit, who supplied the goods to places like America and to places like Canada and Australia. So if you see right at the beginning of the British Empire, you see a situation about who benefits and who's going to get the most out of the British Empire. The other key thing about the British Empire was the way that it took over a key place in the world, India. And this it's important. I mean, most of us have heard about the Raj, do you mean? And I don't know about you, but I was bombarded with that program, The Jewel in the Crown, do you mean? How the British have always ruled India and stuff like this. This is actually not true. When they, you know, it took them at least 100 years to take control of India. And when they arrived as friends. We just want to set up this little factory on this island. Is that all right? We're not going to kill you or anything like that. We just want to trade. Right? That's how they started off by doing it, right? Of course, that was a lie, do you mean? They set up a company called the East India Company, which basically, I would say, murdered or pillaged its way through India. A man called Clive won a battle in 1757 at a place called Plessy against the Nawab of Bengal. He beat him in battle, but the most important thing about the reason why the British were able to do that was because that part of India had been dominated by the Mughals from Afghanistan, and actually when they were taken over by the British, they thought it was going to be a continuation of the new system. But the rise of capitalism is about is about making profits, it's about commodity production, it's not about the continuation of the old society, it was about smashing and opening up the new society for a world market. The second thing the East India Company does as part of its role is, it starts selling drugs, actually. Between 1600 and 1802, the East India Company exported 250 million tons of opium. Now, that made Britain the first international drug dealer in the world, you know what I mean? Despite what they say now, that's where they got a lot of their profits from. And, you know, even here, you know, the question about why they did it is quite interesting. There's a book written about the working class, Tea, Opium, by a woman called Leans. He says that the early demand for tea and opium was in working class areas where people were, you know, actually kids as young as two and women and people down the mines were forced to work long hours. And one of the demands for empire products was actually to keep the working class at work, to keep them, you know, to keep them doped and stupefied in order to carry on with that labour. And actually, what does that tell you? That tells you the question about, is that a benefit? Can you call that a benefit? Or can you say, you know, and the way that, and show the way that it worked? Now, people say that the British Empire was productive and it changed things, it made people better, they educated the savages. Actually, when you look at India, India was a fairly advanced country, metal works. If you look at India, it exported £6 million worth of goods, of cotton, to Britain. Right? That's what it did. What was the effect of the British Empire arriving? A man called Sir Giles Trevelyan, do you mean? As soon as you hear the word Sir Giles, you know there's a problem, right? He says this: we have finished the Indian entrepreneur, now all he's got left is agriculture. In other words, the effect of the Battle of Plessy was actually to destroy the early cotton industry that existed inside India. In fact, it was a complete reversal. In India had to give a tribute of £7 million in taxes in order for to Britain for the early British Empire. In fact, they were dealing with the early British, this idea of, fair trade, the English Empire was always fair, always prepared to turn the other cheek and allow business. It's completely proven to be a lie when you look at what they actually did. In Muzaffarnagar, I'm sorry about my pronunciation, I'm sure somebody will correct me later on, right, but they cut off the hands, which was the equivalent of, it was the size of Manchester, actually, this town, in terms of, it's called the Manchester of India, right? They cut off the hands of the weavers in order to prevent them from being able to weave, in order to give a boost for the early industrial capitalism which was taking place in Lancashire Lancashire in Britain. The people that benefit from that were the same people that were making people work inside the mills and at the same time destroying the early industry inside India. That's the British Empire. That's what it first started to do. The effect of this is a famine. you know, 10 million people die. And really what they do by the empire organising in that way is to smash the old basis of society, bring a 200% tax in, and start saying that people have to pay money. In other words, they introduce, if you like, capital relations. One of the other things that they do is give the land to the rich farmers and actually separate them according to caste, which actually is the formation of the reason why you end up with communalism. That's part of the basis, that's part of the basis for the British Empire and its expansion. I mean, 60% of manufactured goods were exported to India. It's very, very important in, if you like, the primitive accumulation of Britain and why there was an empire. There's a second question that's got to be answered, because you see, at this time, the Marxists argue the ruling ideas in society are the ideas of the ruling class. Does it mean that is well true? Does it mean that workers accepted the idea that empire had something to do with them, that the British Empire was intrinsically something that they were going to benefit from? One of the drives for empire was the fact that they were always afraid of revolution. I mean, particularly the French Revolution. You read all the time that people were afraid of what would happen in Britain. And therefore, they saw empire as a way of being able to defend the ruling class's position in Britain. By expanding the world market, they could strengthen their position. They didn't see themselves necessarily as building automatically a British nation, which they would pull all the people together. This took quite a long process. I mean, people like Captain Cook, actually. You know, you find out he discovered Australia. You don't find out that he was killed in a brawl inside Hawaii, partly by the Hawaiians and also by his own crew, right? Because there was always that constant tension between those people that, you know, this idea that everybody was together isn't true. I mean, in 1773, Paisley workers told their boss, right, that they went on strike, and then they turned around and said to him they wished that he would bugger off himself. Forget, you know, I didn't, this is what they said, right? They wish he could bugger off, that he would bugger off himself, and they wish they could go to the colonies where, if he was there, they could run him through. And running through isn't friendly. I mean, stabbing. Do you mean that's what they actually wanted to do with him? In other words, do you mean the reason why the boss said that if them going on strike was actually going to affect, do you mean, his colonial enterprises? And actually, that was a response of the British workers. There was, you know, between 1797 to 1798, there was constant mutinies inside the British Empire, which made it very, very unstable. It's far from being a stable empire. It was quite unstable. I mean, if you looked at the equivalent of what would have been Top of the Pops at the time, it was, this is what the soldiers used to say, inside the field. Supposedly, these are the people that are supposed to be fighting for the British Empire. They used to say, "I'm a hearty Jacobin, who owns no God and dreads no sin, ready to dash through thick and thin for freedom. Our boasted laws I hate and curse, bad from the first, by age gone worse, I pant and sigh for universal suffrage." Now, I don't know about you, but if you're fighting for empire, I don't think you particularly want those people standing with you. And actually, that was because, in terms of building capitalism in Britain, and in terms of taking the land off people, putting them, impoverishing them, there wasn't that automatic link between people feeling that somehow they had an interest in building empire, and that really continues all the way to 1815, really to the battle of Waterloo. There's another key question as well about the instability inside the British Empire, and I think it's quite important. It's the way that the slave revolts that took place around different parts of the empire were supported by British workers. Now, this is something which is not really talked about. Peter Lambert talks about it in his book. He talks about the life of a man called Robert Wedderburn, who comes to Britain in order to get support for people to fight slavery and to fight the empire. And it gets a rapturous reception. He speaks in Spitalfields, gets 200 people to vote for the death of his master in any struggle. And actually, you can see right from the beginning there was a fundamental anti-slavery interest inside the working class, and an anti-empire element. By the way, Clive, who comes back from India, doesn't have a happy time. Actually, everywhere he goes, there's a crowd of people who boo and hiss him. Do you know what he does? He kills himself. right? This doesn't seem to me to be the son of a glorious empire in terms of when he comes back to Britain. This is important. This is the history that they don't talk about. This is the history they don't want in the national curriculum. And this is the history, I think, of our class in terms of resistance and the way that the empire was built. And so you have a situation where there's revolts all the way inside the British Empire, particularly in places like Jamaica. There's something called the Maroon Rebellion, which is, Jamaica was an important part of the British Empire, in which, you know, outside the American Civil War, the largest force of British troops sent was to the Maroon Islands. Actually, they beat the British. They send a fear through the British ruling class about whether they can hold on to empire. And, one of the slaves says, you can only burn me once. And there's two instances that show that the fragility of the early part of the British Empire went all the way through until the 1850s. You know, the Victorian period, which they like to talk about, there was fragility all the way through. One is the Sam Sharp Rebellion, and the Sam Sharp Rebellion takes place two years before the end of slavery. It creates a massive instability. It breaks the trade between Jamaica and the British Empire. But I think the reason why that's important is because what started it? It started off by slaves hearing that that there had been mass meetings in Britain against slavery, and that some of these pamphlets arrived in Jamaica. I mean, the reason why people were angry and wanted to revolt was the conditions of being a slave. But I think it's quite important in terms of looking at the early rise of the working class and the question of which class benefited and what the British Empire actually did. I mean, it starts off, there's a rebellion, and it starts off in an excellent way, really. It starts off with a woman, they try to stop, a woman beats up a lawyer, basically, and they send some constables, and then there's a revolt on the island, and because there's a revolt on the island, the slaves take over. They take over 100 square miles of the island. The rebellion means that they take control of the courthouse. They take control of a lot of the sugar factories. And I think this idea of a stable empire, the sun never sets, the lion, and the rest of it, is actually shown not to be true by these histories. But I think what's interesting about that as well is that the people that were arrested, I mean, at the end of it, they are beaten by the British. 332 slaves are arrested. But there was a layer of people, abolitionists, that had gone to Jamaica in order to help stir up rebellion. A man called John Ellery, who was a sailor, right? Alfred Smith, a bookkeeper. And they'd gone there in order deliberately to try and whip up an attitude of trying to oppose the British Empire. If you like, these are the early parts of resistance against the British Empire, and they were constantly there, and that's what the Chartist, and this went all the way onto the Chartist. A man called Bronte O'Brien, when he's asked, "Will you defend the British Empire? Will you defend what it stands for?" This is what he has to say about it. He says, "Let all those who have possessions in India, or all those who have profited by what our Indian possessions are to be, go off to India and fight 1,000 battles. Let all those people go and fight for what is called our India, because it is not our India. Don't let them mock or degrade us by asking working people to fight alongside them, either for our possessions or anywhere else, seeing that we do not possess a single acre of ground of any description of property in our country, much less the colonies of the possession in any other, which have been robbed of everything they've earned by the middle and the upper classes." And I think that spells out, if you like, the attitude of the early working class movement to the British Empire, and why there was constant resistance to it. But it doesn't, because it's the early part of the development of capitalism, the empire continues to grow as on the basis of trade. Actually, there's a constant boom, actually, because the manufacturing in Britain, the huge profits that could be made, continue to develop, right? And really, what by 1857, if you like, the British Empire is solidified. It's it's taken parts, it's taken control over whole chunks of the world, and it's integrated. So, and Britain is at the heart of that empire. But in the process of building that empire, they also start to stir and organise resistance against the empire in places like India. And now the key crisis for the British Empire was the Indian revolt that took place in 1857, 100 years later after the Battle of Plassey. This is important because it starts off really by Sepoy soldiers. These were, if you like, these were like mercenaries hired by the British in order to fight for the empire. The country is still run by the East India Company. It's not taken over by the British state until much later. But there's a rebellion in 1857 called the Mutiny, which produces a huge crisis, both in the British Empire and in particularly in India. It starts on the 9th of May 1857, after Indian regiments kill their officers. And you see all the way through, there's a whole sense that they can't hold on to India, and if they lose India, they lose control of the empire. That's not what people like James like to say. It's not what's written in the English history of the English speaking people by Churchill. But this is the real history of empire, really. You see a situation really where instead of just being able to exploit the land that's in India, you have a situation where the rebellion produces a massive crisis for the British Empire. An area the size of France is involved in the rebellion. The soldiers take control of Delhi, and it's the first financial crisis that takes place in Britain as a consequence of the rebellion. I mean, that's the time when newspapers like the News of the World are launched, right? And that's the time when, you know, things like jingoes, people have heard of jingoism. That's the basis of it in terms of the deliberate fostering of racism and a systematic attempt to bind, if you like, workers here to racist ideas, to say somehow they have an interest in the British Empire and exploitation of India. And Karl Marx puts it like this. He said, "The Indians will not reap the fruits of the new elements of society scattered among them by the British bourgeoisie until in Great Britain now the ruling class shall have been supplanted by the industrial proletariat, or until the Hindus themselves have grown strong enough to throw off the English yoke altogether." And really what Marx is arguing there is that the only way that there can be real development in India, the only way that there can be any real control, is if the British Empire is pushed out and overthrown. And the key question about that is that it puts, if you like, the socialist tradition fundamentally in the internationalist tradition of opposing the British Empire from the beginnings all the way through its revolts. I mean, people like Marx and Engels fundamentally hated the British Empire. Engels actually painted his house in the colours of the Irish tricolour to show, you know, when you walked along the street, you knew where Engels lived because his house was painted in the colours of the Irish tricolour. The socialist movement in Britain started fundamentally in a position of being against the British Empire. That's a tradition that we stand in, and that's a tradition that we support. And when Marx said workers of the world have got nothing to lose but their chains, it was started really with a fundamental fight against the British Empire, what it stood for and what it developed. Of course, the process of the British Empire led us to a position where I think it is today, the development of a capitalism internationally, but it also built a working class. It also built the revolts and the resistance, which is part of our history, history that we want to remember, and that's what we want to remember when we talk about the rise of the British Empire, and that's where I'd like to leave it.
Right, we'll open the meeting up now to discussion, questions or contributions. If people want to speak, just raise their hands and I'll call you down. And if people do speak into the microphone, so we can get it on tape. This will be the first person. Okay.
A think the speaker's right when he talks about the way that the empire didn't benefit workers in Britain or in the countries which had an empire, and you know, to show the truth of that, we just got to look at the struggles that were fought in this country, the struggles of the Chartists, the struggles to form trade unions. You know, it's obvious that you know, these were workers who didn't reap the benefits of empire. And you know, if we could come to today and look at sort of globalisation today, the way that multinationals go into third world countries, you know, a similar thing applies. You know, you can't say that workers in Merseyside benefit from the fact that Coates Fayella factory has been closed down because Marks and Spencer is going to buy their shirts from North Africa. So, and the second point is, you know, the argument that's often put that, you know, you've got on the one hand the Daily Telegraph type of argument that, you know, empire, you know, we gave tennis to these countries, we gave industry to these countries, but on the other hand, the argument says, well, empire gave absolutely nothing, it impoverished these countries, it led to workers and peasants in India and other countries becoming absolutely worse off. I mean, I'm not sure how far we want to pursue this. I mean, would we want to pursue it? We're talking about neocolonialism as well, and saying, well, neocolonialism just necessarily impoverishes workers in other countries. I mean, in effect, Marx obviously talked about the process of primitive accumulation as applied to empire building, and, you know, that also has the effect of creating a working class in his countries in however distorted a way. So, you know, you can say that the effects are contradictory. You know, it impoverishes workers, but at the same time it creates elements of a new society. Just finally want to ask, you know, how the effects of empire changed. You know, certainly it was very, very profitable to the system at one time, and to the importance of exports to India to the system, but later on from 1890 to 1914, when Britain started to expand its empire, I think it was, you know, not just for reasons of profitability, but it was more to do with countering unrest at home and ideological arguments in effect of British workers, and as an alternative to unrest in Britain.
And comment. Someone want to be the next speaker? Yeah.
Well, I'm sure everybody in this room is as angered and sickened in the same way as I am, and when you read things like the Daily Telegraph, or you see the Queen, or you see these right-wing Tory politicians come out with this jingoistic nonsense. I think we have to be very clear about our arguments in this field, especially because in the coming months and coming years, that kind of jingoism is going to be pumped out. And it, you know, in the past, it's been indoctrinating into people's beliefs. You know, I mean, I did some interviews for my course, and it was I was interviewing elderly people, and they were telling me about how in the 1920s they had Empire Day, you know, this day when they were giving the day off school, and they all had to wear, you know, ribbons and the Union Jacks everywhere, and they were told how wonderful, you know, the Empire was. But, you know, we know the history of the Empire. We know that it's a history of brutality and atrocity, and, you know, we just have to hope that, you know, internationalism of our party and our sister organisations can defeat that history.
Thank you. Okay, come
on. It's just a question, really. I know that During the American Revolution, English workers were kind of quite instrumental in making sure that nobody helped British. The British ruling class wanted to get in on the side of the southern states and defend slavery and therefore kind of defend its territory. Yeah, I mean, although after the revolution and we've been kicked out, but they still had a lot of trade interest there and it's still kind of like bolstering the British Empire. I wonder if there were any more instances of kind of the British working class kind of actively opposing the British Empire, especially like with the partition of India and when Britain moved out. I mean, I live in Tower Hamlets and we get quite a lot of kind of obviously kind of anti-Asian racism there, and I wonder if there was any kind of tradition of the English working classes fighting against like the interests of the British ruling class.
Okay, come with it, Pat.
Yep.
Yeah, I'll come back on about what a comrade was saying about concrete examples of English working class fighting back against racism and against the empire. I mean, one good example actually is if you actually look at some of the stuff, some of the literature that was written at the time. And I was reading a book where the author was referring to some articles that were written in around the late 18th century. Now, at the time, slavery in Britain was very ambiguous legally, right? Technically, you weren't allowed to actually own slaves in Britain, but of course the bourgeoisie would bring back black slaves from Africa and from the West Indies to show them off to their friends, right, as a sort of novelty value. And of course, not surprisingly, these people would run away, right? And where would they have to run? Well, they'd run into the big cities, mainly quite a lot of them into the big slaving cities like Bristol, Liverpool, and London as well. And you think, the sort of rubbish that comes out about that basically, racism is endemic in white people and stuff like that, that you think, that basically these people will be totally exploited. In fact, what happened was that the bourgeoisie would send out bounty hunters to get back their slaves because they were quite expensive. And then, of course, what would happen was these people would have their throats cut, right? You'd find these guys dead, in taverns, dead down in back streets and things like that. And they were actually protected, these ex-slaves, by white people. And another good example was the Sheffield Cutlers. I think it was in 1796. And they actually put a proclamation out. The proclamation went something along the lines that we stand with the people, we groan with those that groan with us. And that was written about the slave revolts in Jamaica. And I think, that we do stand, in a proud tradition. And I think we have to reject all the absolute tripe that comes out with the Daily Telegraph, because, we can honestly say that, we stand in a tradition, right, of internationalism, right, fighting against the British Empire, right, and fighting for a better world.
Okay. I think what Wayman's done is absolutely right in the respect that he explains to the process of primitive accumulation. Actually, the existence of the British Empire comes into existence, dripping in blood, to use Marx's term. But actually, he does more than that. He actually explains, or gives a material basis for ideological constructs that come through at this point in time as well. The ideas of racism, the ideas of communalism that actually affect us very, very much today. And actually, these are ideas that aren't just about the oppression of blacks, the oppression of Indians and etc. But it's actually important in understanding that the ideas with the political purpose of maintaining and sustaining the wealth and the industries and the empire of the British as well. So it's not just about oppression, it's also about maintaining the wealth and sustaining the power of the British Empire. But also, it actually exposes something else. It exposes the fact that actually, take India as an example, that actually is not an homogenous bloc. It isn't that everybody in that country has the same interest. Actually, one of the products of British imperialism is the fact that actually the two political categories of Hindu and Muslim are very much a physical construct from British imperialism. The very idea of actually divide and rule is something that comes about there. It's something in terms of actually India itself is divided by class. It's divided by class between those of the landlords as zamindars and the peasantry, those of the Indian bourgeoisie and those of the Indian workers. The idea of a neo-colonialism is utter nonsense put in this context. It's not as though India is actually now being controlled by Britain afar, but indeed has its own, its own local British, has its own local Indian bourgeoisie and landlords to deal with as well. And indeed, in that respect, I think we should discard very quickly the old idea of neo-colonialism as well, with the analysis that Wayne has given.
I think when you look at the British Empire, you have to, the first question you have to ask today is, why is it important that we look at the question of the British Empire? Because obviously Britain doesn't have an empire. I mean, apart from the Falklands, Turks and Caicos Islands, and St Helena. No, but I think it is worth saying that British Empire, apart from places like India, which is obviously 1947, were actually fought for their freedom, like the West Indies, Jamaica, 1961, 1962, and so on and so forth. This is, so it's not that far in the past. But of course, for our rulers, I think the key thing about the British Empire is that they still use it today to sell the lie, if you like, the nationalist lie, that somehow white workers do have something in common with white bosses, in the sense that once we had an empire, and surely, as long as you stick along with us, in terms of, the cutbacks, and, as long as you help us make British capitalism work, we could have the same kind of empire today. Of course, it won't be an empire like before. It'll be an economic empire, where we have spheres of influence, like America, and so on and so forth. So it is incredibly important, and if you do look in education today, you find there's a massive battle going on, with right-wing academics and so-called educationists trying to resurrect the empire, trying to say that it wasn't so bad after all. After all, didn't they, bring the railways to India, forget the fact that the millions of people that died of the famine, the empire made famine in India, and all this kind of nonsense. So it still is a very, very, it's a very, very important debate. But I do think, when you do talk about, and people have talked about, the acts of solidarity between British workers and workers or the oppressed nations of the empire, I think what is important to point out is that the high points of all those the highest acts of solidarity, there were two things happening. One was, there was an upsurge in working class consciousness in this country around the question of our working class fighting our rulers, which opened up the question of who they should ally themselves with. And they invariably allied themselves with the oppressed peoples of the empire, and so on and so forth. And also, amidst that high level of class struggle, if you like, the question of some kind of political party that was putting forward some kind of consistent argument. Now, I do think this is important, because if you talk about the Chartists, for instance, who were anti-slavery, who disrupted the middle-class anti-abolition meetings precisely to put class struggle on the agenda, saying, all right, you say that we agree with you that we should free the slaves, but what about freeing us here at the same time? In other words, put a sharp left critique to the anti-abolitionist movement. The Chartists were a mass party, an organised party with a newspaper and so on and so forth. When you talk about the American Civil War, as the comrade talked about, the fact that it split Britain down on class lines, with the ruling class and middle classes supporting the slave-owning South and the working classes supporting the North, up to the point at which cotton workers in the North of England actually still sided with the South, even though they were destitute, because there was a blockade on cotton from the southern states, a blockade by the northern states on the export of cotton to Britain in from the southern slave states. What was there? There were remnants of Chartist organisation, socialists and so on and so forth, who put forward a consistent argument about internationalism. Again, when you talk about when And he talked later on in the century, in terms of the empire around the 1880s, who were the consistent people putting the argument against British chauvinism? It was the early socialists, Marx, Engels, the people around the SDF, William Morris, and so on and so forth, who were putting a consistent critique of colonialism and putting forward internationalism. In the 1920s, very quickly, who were the people actually who were actually putting forward, if you like, the arguments to the working class in the 1920s? It was the Communist Party in this country, for all its faults. In 1921, an Indian man called Sabat Larka, who was building the Indian Communist Party at the same time, was elected by the white workers of Battersea on the basis of his internationalism and his anti-colonialism, as well as his identification with the class struggle in this country. So I do think it's important when we do talk about the thread of resistance, and in covering the threat of resistance against imperialism, we also talk about the two crucial factors, the question of class struggle and the question of class organisation.
OK, I'd like to say a couple of things. First of all, I think, as Sven's already pointed out, we all know that the British Empire was built on one thing and one thing alone, effectively exploitation. Most imperial historians, left, right, centre, doesn't matter where they are, would say that there was no one British Empire. The first British Empire was the one that was set up in the West Indies in America. And the original idea when they all arrived out there was, let's look around at the people we've got here and let's see how we can exploit them. They thought the Spanish had done rather well at this, going in there and stealing everything and then taking it home. So their first stage was to try and use the indigenous people there to try and grow sugar or anything else or tobacco that they could bring back to Britain. They found they couldn't do that. Either the people had been killed off by the diseases that the British brought with them, or they ran away, very sensibly in actual fact. So they shipped out the poor from Britain. When they ran out of poor to ship out, they went to Africa, and they took Africans to the West Indies and to America to exploit them. Now this is the way that the British Empire was built. This is how it made its profit, by wherever it went, let's see what we can exploit. As far as the American Civil War is concerned, it's interesting to note that one of the things that helped drive Abraham Lincoln towards ending slavery in America was the fact that the British elite wanted to support the South because of its trading ties with the South, and the South was, of course, slavery. Now, the British working class were not going to have anything to do with slavery, and once Lincoln had turned around and said that slavery would be abolished in America, there was no way that Britain would support the Southern Confederate States, because there was no way the working class in Britain would have stood for the British government to support slavery. Final point concerns the famous thing from the Man from the Telegraph, that Britain gave the world cricket and it gave the world tennis and it gave the world pink gins and all the rest of it. Now, the British elite exported that for its own purposes. And in the period at the end of the 19th century, they tried to persuade the working class that this was a damned good idea. Now, by and large, the working class were not interested. When my father was growing up, they had Empire Day. And oh yes, this was jolly good, you had a day off school. And for most working class people in Britain, the British Empire was never really something they had a great deal of investment in. They were aware that they were being exploited, just as the people out there in the rest of the empire were being exploited. Empires are about exploitation, and the British Empire was probably the most successfully exploitative empire in terms of the bourgeois capitalists.
Okay. Perhaps we want to ask questions, make further contributions. Still plenty of time, so don't... I think we're rushed in that direction. Okay.
I mean, I think, you know, you can see very much how the British Empire was built on profit. If you do look at the case of India, particularly, where actually you see, you know, whole numbers of, you know, middle class men, children of the ruling class, going out there, you know, with actually very little money, and coming back with, you know, as massively wealthy people. Now, you know, I mean, we all know, you know, that money just doesn't, you know, it doesn't grow on trees anywhere, and they, you know, they made their money by literally ripping it out of people, exploiting people, and, you know, in the most brutal way. And actually, what you do find is, you know, someone mentioned earlier, you know, you have India, a country which actually, you know, famine was not really a serious issue, and it ends up as a country where actually, you know, after the British have left, and in the period just before the British have left, where famine and starvation becomes a regular thing. And, you know, right throughout, you know, you can see as the British Empire goes right across the globe that the driving force is making a profit. You know, the growing of opium so they could trade it with China to make more money by selling expensive Chinese goods in Britain, which they didn't have to use gold to pay for it. Again, it's profit drives it through. If you read in Lenin's book, Imperialism, he lists the sort of, in a 30-year period up towards the turn of the century, where Africa, because, you know, the amount of Africa that's colonised goes from something like 20% to 90%. You know, actually, it's a complete drive for profit, a drive, you know, where they're trying to get more markets to exploit their, you know, to sell goods, more resources in which to produce. And you see this, you know, right throughout the British Empire, this drive to make profit. And I think, you know, You can also think, you look around the world at the minute and see the legacy of the British Empire, which, because you look at all, you know, a whole number of the wars and conflicts that have resulted, you know, that exist in the world at the minute, Rwanda, the tension that still exists in India between Pakistan and India, you know, you look right around the world, Somalia, whatever, all of these end up, you know, you trace back where the roots of these conflicts are. You know, actually it's not in some historic difference between two peoples, it's in the way the Britain systematically sought to promote one section of the population against another section of the population. And I have nothing but, you know, contempt and hatred for anyone who can look at this and somehow see something nice in the British Empire. And I think, you know, actually, you know, I mean, actually, look, you know, you see, talk to most working class people in Britain, actually, very few people will have anything, you know, very few people have any sort of sympathy for the British Empire at all, have any sort of feeling, you know, for it, or any sort of romantic, very little in the way of romantic images about it, because actually, the images of which have been portrayed have shown, I think, you know, quite how bad it is.
Thank you.
I think that's true probably, but I do think also there are times where the kind of hangover of nationalism, if you like, that surrounds empire re-emerge, and one of the times was VE Day last year. I mean, in my school we had tables out in the shape of VE with sandwiches on for the children to eat from, you know, and we had, I tried to use it to do about anti-fascism, and that seemed to be kind of like, okay, we'll learn about Anne Frank, we're going to have to teach about the Second World War. But actually, a few months later, when it came to the Welling defendants and the people that have been put in prison for fighting Nazis now, it actually split the union group in my school, because people didn't know. They said, oh, some people said, oh, they were violent. They're, you know, bombing Dresden, that's all right, but fighting Nazis in a riot, that's not okay. And I mean, not saying everyone thought about that, but it actually split the group. And so I think, do you know what I mean, the same people actually who most wanted VE Day had the most problem supporting the Welling defendants at the same time. So I think that sometimes those kind of, I don't know, empire ideas, if you like, re-emerge, and what I think Wayman's talk showed was the side that isn't ever shown, because it's always been a fight. There was racism back then, they were fighting for racist ideas, but there was a fight from the working class because of the actual experience that people have actually being exploited and oppressed, and therefore they can sense the experience of people who are being exploited and oppressed abroad, as happened in Haiti or Saint-Domingue, where the French revolutionaries fought with the black revolutionaries led by Toussaint Louverture. But what I wanted to say actually, because I went to the meeting by Tocumbo on African debt. I went to the meeting about Nelson Mandela, and afterwards I had a discussion with somebody, and I think there's a bit of a veiled argument going on here, which is to do with the current day leaders of liberated African states, if you like, and what their position is. Are they part of the ruling class, or are they simply sort of puppets, or are they simply people whose hands are tied, and therefore they can't help putting in the ESAP programs, they can't help putting in the cuts, they can't help bringing in fees for children in schools, as is happening at the moment in Zimbabwe. And I think the way I'm trying to explain it, and people can comment if they think I'm wrong, is that they are actually in a contradictory position. There is the legacy of imperialism, which means that African countries have been robbed and raped of their wealth and their material, and India and Asia and all the countries, if you like, Ireland, that were affected by the British Empire. But there is also the fact that because they have chosen to run capitalism, they are now forced, if you like, to become part of the ruling class. There is no choice about that. And I think that, you know, we should try and have this argument out a little bit. They are in a contradictory position. And on Friday, I'm sorry if this is terribly anecdotal about my school, but it's just that sometimes these little things happen where these contradictions are so sharp. We went into assembly, Nelson Mandela was in Brixton, five of the children and one of the teachers from the school had gone to see him. He is an absolute hero where I teach, as you can imagine. He's one of my heroes because of his struggle and his lifelong fight against oppression. However, they went into Brixton. I went into assembly, all the children are sitting in the hall, and the head says, we're going to sing two songs today, and would the junior children stand up? So they stand up, and the two songs are Nkosi Sikelele, which never fails to move me, the African national anthem, and God Save the Queen. Okay? So the kids all sing Nkosi Sikelele, and then they sing God Save the Queen, and I sing Nkosi Sikelele, and I don't sing God Save the Queen, which I hope somebody noticed in the school. The point I'm trying to make is that Mandela, the most political, what Alex Kalinikos called him, the last bourgeois revolutionary, which I thought was a brilliant description, actually, why he moves us, why he inspired us, why this fantastic struggle that he represents is so inspiring and wonderful. But in the end, when he came to Brixton, who did he come with? He came with Prince Charles. That is the logic of nationalism. He came with Prince Charles, and every child came back to school with enough Union Jacks to give out to every child in the class. I think Mandela's visit endorsed, actually, the idea that workers identify with the state, because his logic of his nationalism is that workers identify with the state, therefore British workers identify with the state. And what I'm trying to say is that is the contradiction of his position. He comes to Brixton because he's the man of the people, but he's also part of the ruling class. So, I mean, he didn't come with Bill Morris. He didn't come even with John Monks or Tony Blair. He came with Prince Charles. And in the end, the man, the hero of anti-imperialism, ends up endorsing British nationalism, which is rather ironic. But just one note on that. One of the teachers in my school, and this is my final point, but one of the teachers in my school said to me, as the kids came back with these Union Jacks, I don't want to touch that thing. I don't want anything to do with that thing after the events in Ireland this week. So I think the side of the argument that Wayman's putting, this fight, this tension, this contradiction that we have to fight against racism and the ideas of empire, is still, you know, a fight that's happening.
Thanks very much.
Come right there.
Evening. On a visit to this festive, I've never spoken, because what I've got to say is going to shock everybody. I think you'd all agree that the judicial system is the monument of democracy. And any country which doesn't partake to a system have no right in the place of democracy. I have here a white British woman convicted of an offense 11 years ago, where the prosecution, when asked for the date of the offense, I'm unable to give the date of the offense. The prosecution is unable to give the date of when the offense was committed. Yet, a white British woman suffered so much that she says, is this a nightmare? And all the appeal court, no solicitor will help you. I studied law, I made the appeal myself, I won't take the appeal. The press don't want to know. What happens? They send me a letter. Talk. One from the constable, one from the appeal court in London. Talk. What do I want to talk to the appeal court for if a wrong been done in society? A way treason is committed, a country treason, and nobody wants to know. It goes on. My son's been kidnapped. One been in prison from July last year until the 10th of May. I've had to study law again to try and save him and keep myself out of the court, because had I gone to court, I would have been arrested, gone to the court, and be killed. My son's life has been ruined. All of us have been ruined. My son is living in a criminal condition now. One is in the hospital now struggling for his life. His head was split in two on Saturday night by youngsters. And then another one, near severe. The prosecution being heard after the judge dismissed the case because the indictment is defective. There is no sine qua non in the prosecution case. The prosecutor will prosecute him to send him to prison to do his future irreparable harm. This is the third time now they make an attempt on my sons. Now, is this, does this society have any right in the federal democracy where you're going to use, go under manager system to, for capitalism? And this is what this government here from Mrs. Thatcher right down been planning, because now half the prison, a lot of prisons are being privatized now. In Nottingham, where I live, several youngsters are being convicted now. They cannot get a job because they got conviction. If they retaliate, they get injection in, and they either die or in a mental home. Going in a mental home in Nottingham now, 25% of the inmates are black mentally. The prison the population in this country here of blacks is about 3.4%, yet over 31% of the inmates in prison are black. This got no premise. This country got no right to promise our democracy. And this is what happened in our country today. And here, every came and spoken, the Times, the BBC, don't want to know in this country today. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Come in at the back.
Okay, generally about what Wayman's talking about, the rise of the British Empire. And what I'd like to say is that I'd just like to agree with what Hass was saying about the fact that there is a myth, and it is perpetrated by the ruling class, that somehow ordinary workers still have the interests of the British Empire. The idea that somehow the bosses throughout history, they've obviously ravished various parts of the world, and therefore we all play an interest. Over the last month or so, we had the football tournament, Euro 96. People's already mentioned about the disgusting nationalism, the jingoism of the national press more than anything else. Right? Not amongst ordinary people. Also, you've got the fact that Hass has already mentioned about the interest the rulers want to have, workers have, into defending the British Empire. There's also a split within British capitalism itself between where the best way to bring forth British capitalism, either to split away from the EU and go separately on their own, or basically, as you've got some joker who lives on an island called James Goldsmith, who wants to set up a referendum party. He lives on an island, and yet he talks about defending the interests of the British people. In reality, just defending the interests of his own particular class. Nothing to do with ordinary British workers. Nothing at all. And you have, just like to answer your point, you mentioned about Mandela, and whether the rulers, the ruling class in Africa has obviously got interest, or they're just puppets. I like to argue, and I'll just give one simple example. A couple of years ago in Nigeria, before you had the military dictator who's now ruling in Nigeria, you had a democratic elected president called President Adeola. Now, he's under house arrest now at this precise moment. But I remember 2 years ago, and I might as well just add as well that he is a major capitalist. I mean, he's one of the millionaires in the world. Owns a vast business empire, but yet you have a person, right, who's propping up the system. Now, 2 years ago, I heard that he's a major shareholder in NatWest Bank, National Westminster Bank. So basically what that means, you have a person who's not against the system at all, he's propping it up, and he's actually benefiting out of the system. And you talk about Nelson Mandela, yes, I respect the fact that he did serve in South Africa, in Robben Island, a whole amount of years in prison. But the situation of it is really is that he is a person who is now going to defend the interests of South African capitalism, and he is part of the problem, not the solution. Also, I'd just like to end on saying you've got the British Empire, which no British worker has got no interest in, and yet you've got Tony Blair talking about one nation Britain. I mean, that's what he's got in line for us, that somehow ordinary British people has got this interest in, you know, preserving Britain, and he's talking about a stakeholder economy where there's a partnership between bosses and workers. There cannot be no partnership between the fact where you have a person like, say, Lord Hanson, right? He's a major multi-millionaire, owns his various companies around the world, and British companies. No worker's got no interest in people like Lord Hanson. That's just basically it, really.
Anybody else want to come in before I bring Wayman back? Any more points you want to make or questions? Okay.
I just wanted to emphasise how it is that the capitalist class today still has a very strong interest in the British Empire. And it's still a very important and live debate. Lloyd's of London and the City of London grew out of the day of the British Empire, when trading ships were insured by the city and investments were accumulated, and the merchant banks grew out of this period. Now today it's very much in our interest to represent the British Empire in an ideological frame, to emphasise service to the nation and to that empire. It's still taken up in the army and in the service of corporate capitalism. The empire is still a very, very important idea. Now, I would actually argue that it's a functional ideology today. And of course it's sold to us by the British media, which is why you see the BBC, the Telegraph, other capitalist sections of the media, the press, representing it in the way that they do, because it's part of the heritage of the capitalist class and is active in the imperialism of today. It's only by unravelling this history and rejecting it as ideology and representing history in the context of, you know, a workers' movement and in the social history where it belongs, that we can really take it on, step away and move forward beyond the British Empire. So I think this lecture has been really important, you know, in bringing these things together and representing the argument today.
Okay, cheers. Just two announcements before bringing Wayman back. The next meeting in this series, by the way, is tomorrow, the Peasants' Revolt at 11:45 in Room 3E. And the second thing is there's going to be a meeting tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. in the Institute Cafeteria for all district organisers. So we'll get Wayman Bennett to sum up.
Right, the question was asked about was there resistance by British workers against the early part of the empire. And I want to make this clear. When I'm talking about empire, I want to make a distinction between the rise of colonialism and imperialism, right? Because imperialism comes much later, in the 1880s, and that's what Lenin's talking about. I'm talking about in the early part of the formation of Britain, in terms of being a nation and stuff like that. There wasn't an automatic unity between the interests of the bosses and the people and the people from below. The plant class, in the slave class, wanted to push racism, but it wasn't something which they found easy to push. They had to organise to do that. That's the reason why in Antigua, the first lobbying company in the world is started by Antiguan slavers, because they couldn't win the argument that people should be in favour of slavery, because the bourgeoisie claimed they led their revolution to fight against all these tyrannies. So it was hard for them to do it, and that's the reason why there was resistance inside the working class, because it was part of the idea of the bourgeoisie that, you know, that you stood, you know, fraternity, what the French, you know, fraternity, paternity, liberty, you know, all right. You get the idea. So it was hard for them to do it. The second part of empire, actually, about racism, actually, they changed their tact and actually said these people, or the people around the world, or the part of the dominion, particularly black people, are, you know, are children. I mean, that's the reason when, and it's a different type. That's the reason when, if you like, because that's the reason when the empire changes its form. And I think it's important to make the distinction between imperialism and colonialism. And I'm talking about the rise of colonialism and the rise of nations. I just wanted to make that point. And the other point I want to say is that the resistance against, particularly in the part of colonialism, is, and resistance against slavery is absolutely central to the development of the working class movement. And it's important that we start from that. That the working class movement had a strong anti-racist basis, a strong class interest in terms of opposing slavery, and they actually did that. In 1864, during the Civil War in Manchester, there's a mass demonstration. And the interesting thing about this demonstration, it was organised by the bosses to be in favour of the slave owners inside southern states, right? They wanted to organise a demonstration in order to do that, right? The first couple of demonstrations they organised were a complete flop, right? This one was quite big. And actually, the people had turned up in order to chase off the manufacturers who tried to organise a demonstration. I think it's quite important that, you know, that those kind of things, those kind of things happen. The second one is that there was a rebellion inside Jamaica in 1865. Governor Eyre shot people down because he was afraid that what happened in India, in the Indian Mutiny, might happen again. And that split the socialist movement down. Oh, well, you can call it the socialist movement. You know, if you look at people like William Morris, they opposed what Governor Eyre did. People like Dickens, people like that, end up lined up with Governor Eyre, and there was a complete conflict in this country. But the basis of opposing Governor Eyre was a working class organisation, the Grand, and they did that. That's part of our history, and something which we should absolutely reclaim. That's what should be in the national curriculum, not the crap that people like Thatcher talked about how much Britain has done for the world, the way that they attacked our class and oppressed people. I think that the question about colonialism and neo-colonialism, I think when we talk about imperialism today, we have to say imperialism exists. We have to say the world is still divided between a minority of imperialist powers that have control. After all, what would you describe the Gulf War as? You have to say it was an imperialist war. But then to say that people like Saddam Hussein are anti-imperialist fighters, or people like in Nigeria, when they try to put sanctions on them, that these people are just being oppressed by the British government or by the Americans, because they didn't put the sanctions on in the end, but you know, they tried to put sanctions on against them because they hanged Ken Saro-Wiwa. This idea that they've been oppressed, they're part and parcel of the problem inside there. When workers went on strike, when the oil workers went on strike inside Nigeria, they're an indication of the real force of social change inside Africa. And people like Abacha, people like Abiola have not got the same interest as the Nigerian oil workers. A consequence of the empire, actually, was the creation of international capitalism and the creation of an international grave digger, the international proletariat. But I think that one of the things that we have to grasp from the early part of empire and the resistance against it is what I think that has ended up with, the question of why you needed a socialist organisation, why the Chartists tried to pull together a political organisation that opposed both exploitation, the empire, and racism, why you needed that. Now, they couldn't do it because, if you like, they were the first working class movement. The power of the working class, if you like, they attempted to fight for change, they led mass movements, but they couldn't actually do it. Today, we live in a completely different situation. Anybody that saw what happened in South Africa, or what happened in South Korea, or what happened inside China over Tiananmen Square, sees a working class is an international working class. That's where our hopes lie, but part of our hopes actually lie with fighting for a socialist tradition that has always opposed the rise of the bourgeoisie, has always opposed capitalism, has opposed racism, and that's a tradition that we want to bring out. That's what we want to remember about the British Empire. There were two classes. There were the oppressed, the exploiters, and our side actually united. And that's a tradition that we stand in, the international tradition.